Thank you very much, Behrang. It's really a pleasure to be here. Though it is cold and wet, it's a break from the sunshine and warmth of Florida, so I appreciate that. So I'm planning to discuss three interrelated subjects today. I have about a half hour in total, I think, and we'll divide my time among these three things. I think the reason for their interrelatedness will be more or less self-evident. I will say that when I started working on the subject of excessive pricing some years ago, my main concern, and my main concern continues to be with originator pricing, and we'll get into that in the second part of this, and in a way was somewhat surprised about the, let's call it, the difficulties which competition authorities have run into in prosecuting what I would refer to as the easy cases. But in any case, competition authorities have shown a willingness to proceed against generic producers who have market-dominant position that substantially raise the prices in the absence of changed economic circumstances, for example, demonstrated increases in production costs, and we are seeing actually a growing attention to the phenomenon of generic producers enjoying effective monopolies and imposing substantial costs on consumers. I say this is the easy case because we don't get into the more difficult issues arising from determining risk-adjusted R&D costs, nor do we have discussion about threats to future R&D streams. And we heard this morning, and this is, well, a problem that increasingly needs to be addressed, that when we talk about proceeding against generic producers for charging excessive prices, the reaction has tended to be now a threat to withdraw from the market. And so one question, of course, is how do you deal with the threat to withdraw from the market? Of course, you have potential options of subsidizing additional private entrants into the market, and we've had discussions about that in the United States. We have the possibilities of establishing national or international production capabilities to reduce the dependence on independent private sector producers. I don't think that anyone is necessarily that enthusiastic about going towards national production, but there has to be some way to offset this threat of withdrawal from the market and to address these problems. By far, in my opinion, the most important case going on today, which we've heard about twice already this morning, which is the case of CMA v. Pfizer and Flynn, and we've already had substantial background about that with the CMA making its determination with respect to phenytoin's sodium capsules through manipulation of the National Health Service drug price reimbursement system. And I think one thing that the two earlier presentations about this didn't highlight was really the intent of the initial branded producer, Pfizer, as evidenced through the documents published ultimately in the CMA decision, to the extent to which Pfizer executives sat down deliberately and said, well, we know we could get a price increase by appealing to the National Health Service. We want more than they would be willing to give us. The way we can do this is going through this debranding exercise. But we know that because we will be perceived as fleecing the British public and the National Health Service, that we should lay off the sensitive part of this exercise to an intermediary, which was this company Flynn, which essentially does nothing other than act as an intermediary distributing agent. And when the authorities come after us, the people at Flynn have agreed to stand up and say we did it, and to deflect the attention from us. And I think that to the extent one is looking at why we might be concerned about this type of practice from a competition law standpoint, one should look at the intent of the party that was pursuing the action. So we've already heard that Pfizer and Flynn the CMA used a cost price assessment, determined the excessive prices were unfair in themselves because lacking any objective justification, supplying exactly the same product from exactly the same German factory. We already heard about the unusual market factor, that is that you had a group of epilepsy patients who had been told by and physicians had been advised that not only can you not transfer to a different branded product, but you cannot even transfer to a different form, so that there is discussion of the alternative tablets made by Teva, which were higher priced than the Pfizer product before the debranding exercise. But it is also the case that patients could not transfer from using the capsules to the tablet, so it isn't really an effective comparator in any case. And the Competition Appeal Tribunal affirmed the finding of dominant position, but rejected the excessive pricing finding on the grounds that CMA did not sufficiently explore alternative avenues. It's already been raised, the peculiarity of this case, from the standpoint, well, I'll start with the general premise. I have not read, in my history of reading these things, a more detailed, thorough examination of a particular product and a particular market than was performed by the Competition and Market Authority in the United Kingdom in this case. It was a meticulous decision supported by evidence, and in order to reject that determination, the Competition Appellate Tribunal turned to Advocate General Wall's opinion in the Latvian copyright case, which I apologize I'm repeating because I think these points have been made to a certain extent, but Advocate General Wall was essentially musing on what he thought would be a better approach to addressing excessive pricing than the Court of Justice of the European Union had laid out in United Brand and subsequent decisions, referring to Justice Scalia's opinion in Trinco. And I'm tempted to suggest that had Justice Scalia been writing about the pharmaceutical market and not telecommunications handset connection fees, even he might have been somewhat more empathetic to the idea that you can't charge any price that you want. But moreover, Advocate General Wall, in his decision, had said, the one place I'm willing to concede that the market may not function properly is in a regulated market. And in this case, you were dealing precisely with a regulated market. And finally, that the Court of Justice of the European Union did not actually use Advocate General Wall's decision or opinion in its decision, that if anything, the Latvian copyright case relaxed prior CJEU requirements for finding of excessive pricing by, as was mentioned, saying that the margin of appreciation is very flexible and there's no minimum standard of difference between markets when assessing excessive pricing. So in order to get to its decision, the Competition Appellate Tribunal had to act quite literally inconsistently with Court of Justice of the European Union jurisprudence in prior excessive pricing cases. And another peculiar aspect of its decision is that it basically said towards the end of the decision, what we think is that the CMA didn't do enough in exploring various alternative avenues without saying what those various alternative avenues might be, or what even it thought was literally a mistake that the CMA may have made in its evaluation process. Now, why might we care about this case? Because as I said before, in my view in a case, this was a very easy case. Here you had a company on the record for having said, let's figure a way to fleece the NHS, You know, we'll do this debranding exercise, we'll hire this intermediary, we'll raise the prices by 2,500% with no objective justification whatsoever. If you can't win this case in the excessive pricing context, then maybe there's no case realistically that you can win. And the point of the Competition Appellate Tribunal decision was really to throw up more obstacles in examining excessive pricing cases. So it's extraordinarily important that the British Court of Appeal come out the right way in this case. It may be it'll even go up to the British Supreme Court. And curious, we have a very curious additional feature in this case, which is, well, Brexit, dare we say. By the time this case is actually decided in the United Kingdom, will it in fact be a precedential interpretation of European or EU competition law at all? And will it in fact be applying the CJEU jurisprudence? That's step one. So then we get to public health and non-self-correcting markets. So one of the reasons I started looking at these problems of excessive pricing was to address what has been in the United States, and this was, you can find this description in prior OECD studies of competition law. Our courts, the U.S. courts, have not been willing to use excessive pricing as such as a grounds for finding an antitrust or competition law violation. And this involves a transition in the sense if you go back to the foundings of antitrust law in the United States back in the early 1900s, the Supreme Court really focused on protection of consumers and the consumer market and the old Standard Oil Trust case and so forth. And it was in the mid-80s that U.S. antitrust jurisprudence shifted to the Chicago School of Economics. And the Chicago School focuses on supplier markets and basically says if you have a distortion in the supplier market, it will affect the end user consumer price, but the way you fix the market is to fix the distortion in the supplier market, and if you fix that, the market will self-correct. So basically, the Chicago School philosophy is by correcting distortions among suppliers, that is, producers, the markets will ultimately self-correct. The problem is that that literally doesn't work in markets characterized by legislative monopolies. So when you're dealing with markets where you actually have a lawful monopoly that's granted by Congress that creates patent and regulatory exclusivity barriers, if you have, let's say, an excessive price, you can't, which would otherwise be evidence of a distortion in the supply market, and it doesn't, because the supply market is characterized by a monopoly established by a legislative grant. So you can't go over that as being illegal because it was granted legislatively. So in essence, you have to get to the solution of addressing an excessive price itself as an abuse of dominant position. Now, that is something I think that European competition law recognizes, but it's something that U.S. law doesn't. But we'll see that the trend is shifting towards acceptance of that type of doctrinal approach. So, in this piece that I published in 2006, after addressing this jurisprudential issue and, you know, the countries that do allow for excessive pricing prosecution in their competition law and those that don't, I wanted to get to how you would assess originator prices from the standpoint of being excessive. Well, to address the abuse of market power and injury to the welfare of individual consumers and groups, and again, where you have market exclusivity down to an individual drug, And as we know, there's unusual market characteristics. You have inelasticity of demand. If someone's developed a unique new therapy for which there is no substitute, the person will be willing to pay whatever price is necessary to save their life, which could be any price up until the point at which they're bankrupt, and demand is essentially inelastic. I realize it's not always the individual consumer who's paying that price, that it may be a government authority. And so we go through a variety of different ways that we could look at what's an excessive price in the originator context. My own preferred approach, which I'll go into in more detail, is a cost-plus approach, just as we saw in CMA v. Pfizer. And you say, well, it's very difficult. Well, we'll get to whether and how that's very difficult. But note that we do have various alternative methodologies for determining what might be a reasonable price in the originator context. We're already looking at, well, reference pricing is very common in Europe. We'll look and see. We now have reference pricing proposals in the United States. We have the Australian competition authorities have looked at the price you get when you have a monopsony supplier, a single supplier, and a monopsony purchaser. The National Public Health Authority, when they bargain, what price do they arrive at? You've got costs based on corporate assessments of acquisition targets. So, for example, when you looked in the case, for example, of Sofosbuvir or Sovaldi, when Gilead paid $11 billion for Pharmasset, that established some kind of price for the research. Gilead didn't do any meaningful research in creating Sofosbuvir. It was all done by a company they'd acquired. We have Securities and Exchange Commission reporting of internal costs. And we've heard this morning about a couple of other potential methodologies. You could use a health technology assessment methodology to establish a reasonable price. And I just met with the Dutch competition authorities, just about a week ago. Some economists at the Dutch Competition Authority have written a paper about using what the Dutch establish as the quali government expenditure maximum for drugs as the excessive pricing maximum that might be applied in a competition case. I prefer neither of those latter two alternatives. We had some discussion this morning about how much can you trust health technology assessments. I prefer a cost-plus approach, but I'm sure that I probably wouldn't persuade everybody about that. The main central point I would like to make is pharmaceutical R&D, originator R&D, is not, in fact, the black box that it's made out to be. Of course, we know that we know manufacturing costs. There's very little dispute about the cost of manufacturing originator drugs. There are some things we want to exclude, the opportunity cost of capital, executive salaries above reasonable limits, tax incentives. A critical point, we'll come back to this though, is that originator companies always try to portray their costs of R&D and developing a new drug as something that's very mysterious, a black box. As if they don't know how much it costs them to develop a particular drug. I do not think that's the case. I think that originator pharmaceutical companies have very sophisticated budgeting and accounting processes. We do have problems, but we get these in virtually any industry that you investigate with the allocation of corporate shared costs. Usually this is done with full-time employee equivalent costing structures and budgeting. I've talked now with several former heads of R&D of major pharmaceutical companies, and including when I was on the expert group of the UN Secretary General's high-level panel on access to medicines, had the opportunity to talk with a number of the executives who run the R&D departments. And there's no one really who challenges the idea that
We map this stuff out pretty darn carefully, and we have a pretty darn good idea at the end of the day how much this stuff, A, how much it cost us to do ex post, and how much we think it's going to cost us to do ex ante. It can be different in different cases, right? But the real issue that comes up with originator products, of course, is research efforts aren't always successful, right? So you've got a risk factor involved in this. And how do you impute a risk factor in the cost of R&D? And again, if you just want to look at it at a simplistic standpoint, the capital markets and the companies are constantly placing values on their streams of R&D. When the market prices their securities, when they're involved in merger and acquisitions, and they're setting a value on their R&D pipeline. And we'll have some discussion, I think, by Suri later of a recent study done by DNDI about how to figure R&D costs and how they've figured their R&D costs. But there's such a long history of this, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, but the mystery of R&D costs has been deliberately shrouded by the industry. So there's some things, again, that go into these calculations. Drug development risks vary in relation to unknowns, but a great deal of the fundamental unknowns. So the biggest basic research budget in the world for pharmaceutical R&D is actually provided by the U.S. government through the National Institutes of Health to the tune of about $30 billion a year, so that by the time you actually get to developing a drug for the market, you're relying on basic research that's been provided to you. A good number of the new drugs that are put on the market, the large percentage of them are low-risk R&D products. They're follow-ons, different formulations, routes of administrations, dosages, patient populations, etc., where you're working in situations where the mechanism of therapeutic action and the toxicity profile is generally known. So when you're dealing with these lower risk products, you really don't need to take so much the risk factor into account as to what type of premium might be provided for the actual cost of introducing the drug. Then, of course, you get high-risk R&D where you're developing a novel therapy, identify a new biological cause of disease or mechanism of action. There will be failures. The originators reduce risk by spreading out different targets within their company and or by acquiring promising third-party portfolios. We know now that the risks are significantly reduced as you actually get to the call it the higher end of clinical trials. When you go from first stage clinical trials, by the time you get, for example, to third stage clinical trials, where you're actually spending the most money per patient, that you've already got a much better idea whether the drug will work, and your level of risk should be reduced at that stage. And your level of risk will also depend on what type of institution you are, whether you're a single drug developing company, a smaller company, or whether you're a large multinational company that has an R&D department with multiple targets being investigated at the same time. There's been quite a bit of research going on lately. We'll also look at some that will be going on. The U.S. Government Accountability Office in November 2017 published a fairly detailed report on R&D costs in the originator sector. Shows you the relatively small amount of novel drugs that are being introduced. So part of the conclusion of that report and part of the conclusion of a lot of other reports is that the industry is actually not terribly efficient at developing novel drugs. And part of the reason for that is probably that they make more money developing non-novel drugs and don't want to take the risk of developing new drugs. If you want to take a look at some hard data, DNDI just a couple of months ago, maybe even only a month ago, published a detailed analysis of their R&D costs for developing actual novel therapeutic entities.
and set the target range of, or the actual range, excuse me, of 60 to 190 million euros for developing a novel therapeutic entity. Of course, once you determine what you think a reasonable price is, you have to decide what's excessive in relation to that. We heard, for example, from Reiner this morning, you can compare to other industries. In the pharma industry, that can be a bit of a difficulty because if you're dealing effectively with a cartel, the cartel itself may have higher prices overall, so you may not want to compare within the pharma industry. I've used some basic mathematics to showing how you could get that type of price for the originator sector. And I think we also heard, perhaps it was in the Italian case, that sometimes when you go to say, is it excessive, the price is just so far beyond what you would think would be a reasonable price that it's not so hard to determine that's excessive. When it becomes important to set a particular number is where you're talking finally about remedial action. So that's an element to look at there. There's all kinds of ways to go about that, civil and criminal prosecution. Historically, Europe hasn't liked the United States' triple damages in antitrust or competition law actions. Well, I doubt I will persuade Europeans to change their opinion about that, but it's actually a very valuable tool in competition enforcement because it's actually quite risky for law firms and private clients to take on competition actions. They take a long time. They're subject to appeal. They're fairly risky. And we have a lot more civil antitrust enforcement in the United States than you have civil antitrust enforcement in Europe. And I think it's largely because you have the prospect for triple damages in the final analysis. And then remedies. Again, people say, well, how would you address this once you figured this out in the originator sector? Wouldn't it be just so terribly difficult to figure out what a remedy would be? Can judges really do that? Well, they do it all the time. You have consent agreements. You can order the reduction of the price. You can order monetary damages with reimbursement to payors. You can have the judicial administration of the ongoing price with the opportunity to seek adjustment based on changed circumstances. You have to have anti-circumvention controls. You can have criminal penalties for this type of thing. Of course, the part of the reaction, and we heard it this morning, is, well, but if we tell originators that there's such a thing as an excessive price, they are not going to be willing to engage in future R&D because they'll be worried that they won't be able to recoup their investment and engage in future R&D. I just don't really quite get the logic of saying we have to let you charge excessive prices, because if you can't charge excessive prices, you're not going to engage in ordinary business in the future. I would think that a corporate boardroom will say, yes, we should be able to be satisfied with a reasonable rate of return on our investment, and we will continue to pursue R&D even without that. I am also a believer that many, if not most, of the pharmaceutical discoveries made today are done through the general advancement of science, not because Pfizer or Novartis has decided that they're going to get involved in the business. But again, opinions will differ on that. Since the early 1950s in the United States, the originators have steadfastly resisted efforts to secure information regarding actual R&D costs. The U.S. Congress has been reluctant. It has been willing to inquire for information, but has not subpoenaed information regarding R&D costs. I'm not so sure why it should be considered a problematic exercise for originator companies to disclose their R&D costs. We have many stories of this occurring, even when under threat. in the South Africa litigation, in the case in the early 2000s, or late 1990s and early 2000s, brought by the South Africa, the companies against the South African government, one of the requests from the South African government was, well, if you say it costs so much money to develop HIV therapies and R&D, and that is why you need to charge these excessively high prices, can you please tell us how much cost to develop these particular drugs? And the response from counsel for the, actually the plaintiffs in the case, was, no, that's too complicated. Our clients say it would take us too long to provide the information. When Bayer was sued in India with respect to Nexavar and excessive pricing, and demands were made to provide their R&D costs, they said, no, we don't want to provide our R&D costs. We'll refer you to the Tufts study that says it costs $1.5 billion or $2 billion or whatever today's figure is to make a new drug. Why would Bayer, the company that developed the drug, be unable to tell the court how much it cost them to develop the drug? Who knows? But this continues. Ultimately, this is something that really hasn't been pursued by competition authorities. So I'm talking about something that's only, so far as I know, may happen in the future. It's going to be, of course, the competition authorities are very familiar with investigating companies for their pricing practices and trying to determine what their costs are. The argument is made that it will be just be too difficult to do it in the innovator case. I do not think that's correct, but until we start to try to do it, we're not going to get experience in finding out whether it can be done. Just by way of illustration, just because I think this example is so striking, what we always hear from the originators, tying into the point of R&D, if you don't grant us these price increases, if we can't charge these high prices, we're not going to be able to engage in the valuable R&D which makes everyone's life better. So here, AbbVie has the drug you're all familiar with, Humira. And so this New York Times article discusses they're raising the price for no known reason from $19,000 a year in 2012 to $38,000 a year in 2018, a drug on which their patent was getting ready to expire, and presumably they'd long ago secured back their R&D costs. But are they investing the money they made from selling Humira at high prices in R&D? No, they're buying Allergan. And what does Allergan make? Allergan's franchise is Botox. So their rationale for buying Allergan is that this gives us a steady stream of Botox injections, which will undoubtedly be profitable into the future, presumably with the rationale, well, we may be spending the entire annual budget of the entire global pharmaceutical industry, leading off NIH, to buy this company, but in the future, we will use our money to actually invest in R&D. So I'm not sure what competition authorities might be looking at that, but presumably someone is thinking about it. We've talked about some big challenges in this area with excessive pricing this morning. We've had quite a bit of discussion. One of the things that we see globally, the European Commission, the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, the Department of Justice, presumably most of the European competition authorities, have pretty strong investigative powers to compel document production and testimony. What we find when we talk with competition authorities throughout the world in developing countries and emerging market countries is in many countries the legislation doesn't confer on the investigative authority sufficient power to conduct, to adequately investigate. They can really only compel production once they've
initiated a proceeding which basically puts the cart before the horse, because how can you initiate a proceeding if you don't have the evidence already? There's been a great deal of discussion regarding price trade secrecy and transparency, including at the WHO. In developing countries, competition authorities always have problems with financial resources, the budgets for the agencies. In terms of current trends, so this is very important. I started by mentioning that in the United States, we haven't historically had cause of action under antitrust law for excessive pricing as such. But several months ago, well, the U.S. Federal Trade Commission was asked by members of Congress to investigate or to address whether they have the power to address excessive pricing as such. And they looked at Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act as compared to Section 1 and 2 of the Sherman Act. And their first opinion was divided a bit on 3-2 lines. The majority said, well, the statute may read to give us the power, but we've tried it before and the courts have pushed back, so we think if we try it now, we'll probably get the same type of pushback. The two commissioners writing a concurring opinion said, well, that's no reason not to try it. Times have changed. We think the case law indicates that the Federal Trade Commission does have the power to go after unfair drug pricing as such under this somewhat different statute, that is the Section 5 of the FTC Act. If you want to look at something that comes very close and not, if not actually, an excessive pricing case, look at Judge Lucy Koh's opinion or decision in FTC v. Qualcomm, where she essentially said that Qualcomm is charging a price for patents on its cell phone technology that is higher than is justified by any reasonable economic rationale. This whole thing has resulted in a very bizarre situation in the United States, where Qualcomm has appealed her decision within the Ninth Circuit, and the Justice Department filed a brief saying that we disagree with our Federal Trade Commission, which pursued this case. And so you actually have a competition between the competition authorities as to whether or not she was right in reaching this excessive pricing decision. This is a fascinating bill that was recently introduced by a Democratic senator and a Republican senator. Rick Scott, a Republican senator, very conservative, who was formerly the head of one of the biggest healthcare providers in the United States, have introduced a bill that would direct our National Academy of Sciences to develop a methodology for determining what a reasonable price of an originator drug is in the United States. And the legislation includes provision for then adjusting pharmaceutical prices in the United States in accordance with those reasonable prices. So if you think that the idea of reasonable prices might not catch on, in fact, we have some pretty serious proposals along that line. Also, we heard this morning that the United States is the only country in the world without price controls. That probably has to be tinged just a little bit with the observation that we do have various provisions for establishing formularies, and the Veterans Administration, for example, does a good deal of work on measures that are actually intended to control prices. But in any event, this is from the Pelosi bill. So the Speaker of the House or the House Majority Leader has a bill in which you've read about, which would allow the federal government to finally open price negotiations with producers and establish maximum prices based on international reference prices. That would be a basket of countries that are, I would say, higher income OECD prices. One of the more interesting developments in this area is Senator Elizabeth Warren's bill. And so this is a bill which actually would mandate that not later than 1 year after the date of enactment, public manufacture of insulin, meeting the definition of an applicable drug in accordance with this section.
I imagine you're aware, certainly in Denmark, diabetes and insulin supply is a huge issue in the United States. It's a huge issue all over the world. And that could be the subject of an entire program here. But in any case, this is Elizabeth Warren's plan for addressing that, is to actually have the government start to manufacture the drugs. So right now we're involved in preparing, I do work for the United Nations Development Program. In 2014, we published this guide on using competition law to promote access to health technologies. We conducted consultations with competition authorities around the world on how to use these instruments. We're in the process of updating our guidance, which will come out this coming year. With that, I thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you.